Hey, drama listeners. If you've been following the pod for a while, then you know that Spring Awakening is one of our all-time favorite shows. I mean, can you say Ring of Keys moment? Anyways, today we are bringing you an extremely special episode because the one and only Johnny Gallagher Jr., star of the original Broadway cast of Spring Awakening, joined us for a chat that is a gag. Now, if you're loving the podcast, please consider supporting our Patreon for $5 a month to get bonus episodes, IG close friends content, and more. The link is in the notes below. And if you want more Spring Awakening content, we have been delivering it since our very first episode with Krista Rodriguez. We've also chatted with Matt Doyle, Lily Cooper, Ben Moss, Anthony Lee Medina, Ali Stroker, Andy Mientis, so many people from the Spring Awakening universe. So you have to check through our feed to see everything else. We hope you enjoy this episode as much as we did recording it. Now, on to the show.
Press play, curtain of an hour in. It's time to take spin.
The shade and tea to spill.
Ooh, drama. Oh, that's a tweet. Did they book? Who got nom? They option no. Oh, I'm not well. What star will we talk to today?
Oh, that's a gag, honey.
Say no more. Drama.
Drama.
Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love,
and life.
I am Connor McDowell.
And I am Dylan McDowell. Connor, can you believe I was in New York with you but a mere 12 hours ago?
It feels like it was
24 hours ago.
Forever ago since I last saw you. I know, wait, you were like 12 hours ago. I was like, yeah, that sounds about right. But no, yeah. It was, I feel like I've lived half a lifetime since I last saw you.
I know.
It's so weird that we don't live near each other anymore.
I know. But you know what? We had the most fun week ever. Like, it was truly such a good time. And I know we recorded some episodes while I was in town, but I want to talk about something that we hadn't really touched on any of the recordings. And that was that we got to see the final preview of A Strange Loop while in the city.
Yes. Oh my God. Life-changing art.
You know, it's like sitting in that theater, I thought to myself, this feels like one of those zeitgeist moments that like might change the form, or you know, you're going to say, oh, I saw it at Playwrights before I saw it on Broadway. You know how people like to say, like, I saw Hamilton at the Public, or I saw Spring Awakening at the Atlantic. You never
right,
know.
Right, right.
You know, when people...
One of those. I agree. And you know what? A rare Broadway transfer that I think works better on Broadway.
You mean with like an intimate show going to a bigger house.
That's what I mean. Thank you for expounding on that. But it's like the cast chemistry just feels tighter. They feel like they've lived with the material more. There's a new lead and he's great. And the sound was a little weird, but maybe it's because we were in rush seats. But yeah, it was really amazing. And I think it is one of those pieces of theater that if you're able to see it a second time, it really is better.
Mm-hmm.
You're able to live with it more. And yeah, it's fantastic. It's my favorite musical of the year, of the season.
Well, you know, it's going to be hard to top Diana for me. You know, I'm a Di fana.
I know you are, Dylan. Oh. I know.
Anyways,
but
I do think this one is going to be remembered come Tony nominations a week from today. Well, you know, a couple of days after this recording, but I think there's going to be a lot. They're going to be a happy house that morning.
This has been the craziest spring ever between the like 15 Broadway openings, all the different award ceremonies. And of course, you know, the premiere of this Spring Awakening documentary, those you've
Dude.
Known. I feel like there has never been a more exciting time to be an artist who has even an interest in Broadway, you know?
Yeah, there's something for everyone. But yeah, actually, it was the night that we were at A Strange Loop. We were oddly left off the invite list for the Those You've Known documentary premiere. But it's okay. No love lost. And we have one of the stars with us today. And Connor, at 15, 14, you know, everyone has their story about the show. But it's very much that for our generation. And I never could have imagined we'd meet this person, let alone have them on our little podcast.
I know, I'm gagged. I feel like we're saying that a lot lately, but it's true, especially for this one, because I think I listened to the Broadway cast recording of Spring Awakening 700,000 times in freshman year of high school alone. I mean, it really went through it. Our mother is so tired of, she can recite the entire dialogue in Don't Do Sadness, Blue Wind, just from hearing us playing it in the car from going back and forth to marching band practice.
Yeah. Even still, she has the Fanny Gabor monologue down, and then there were none. I think
Who
it's
doesn't?
Time to bring in this guest.
I know. Please do, Dylan.
All right. Our guest today is the 2007 Tony Award-winning Best Featured Actor in a Musical, perhaps best known and beloved for his portrayal of the compelling and complex Moritz Stiefel in the original Broadway cast of Spring Awakening. Other appearances on the Broadway stage include Jerusalem with Mark Rylance, Long Day's Journey into Night with Jessica Lange, Rabbit Hole with Cynthia Nixon, and of course, American Idiot the Musical as Johnny. He most recently wrapped his latest theatrical production, the Avid Brothers musical Swept Away, with deep friend of the pod, Stark Sams. The tip of the iceberg of his television and film credits include The Newsroom, Olive Kittredge, Westworld, The West Wing, 10 Cloverfield Lane, The Belko Experiment, which was crazy, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, Hush as the Man, Modern Love, Peppermint, Short Term 12, and so much more. His solo album, 6 Day Hurricane, is available where fine music is found. And of course, you can hear him on the original cast albums for Spring Awakening and American Idiot. The aforementioned documentary film, Spring Awakening, Those You've Known, is available at the time of this episode's release on HBO Max, reuniting our heroes, the original Broadway cast of the 8-time Tony Award-winning musical. Truly, heaven must feel like this. Please welcome to drama,
Johnny Gallagher Jr.
Oh my God, thank you for that stellar introduction. I don't think I've ever been teed up so gracefully in my life.
Oh my goodness.
Wow, now you're going to hit it out of the park, right? Is it tee up a baseball or a golf
I don't know. It's only downhill from here. I don't know. Tee up. Let's see. I guess it could be a softball reference, or yeah, it could be golfing. I don't know. It was my aversion to sports that led me into the theater in the first place. So,
and here we are.
And here I am referencing it like I actually, you know, get the reference.
Johnny, it's so amazingly iconic to have you on the pod. I have to say, this is a dream come true.
Oh my gosh, I'm completely flattered. It's my pleasure to be here. I can already tell we're gonna have a great time chatting.
Yes. Well, listen, we like to ask all of our guests this question. You know, in the state of our world, are you well?
I would say I'm you know, I fluctuate. You know, I've always been kind of in flux. You know, sure. I feel like maybe it's the Gemini in me that I kind of vacillate wildly. I, you know, within reason, of course, the mood swings aren't too extreme. But day to day, I kind of, you know, put my shoes on and kind of try to see which way the wind is blowing and go, gosh, how am I feeling today? And there's a lot of ups and downs. It's been a crazy couple of years, I think, as we all well know. Anybody that skews slightly depressive or anxious, I think, you know, reasonably so, has been having a tough time with the strange way of the world, with the pandemic and with the kind of ever changing and horrifying, you know, political landscape that we're bearing witness to every day. It's a lot. It's a lot to take in. It's a lot to process. And then when you add in any personal strife underneath there, it's a, you know, you can have a pretty full plate pretty easy these days if you're sensitive, you know, which I certainly am. So I'm well and I'm unwell. I would say I'm right there in the middle. Yeah. Mm. If there's a slash, I live, you know, between well and unwell. You know, I kind of feel like I live in the gray space a bit.
I am right there with you. You're a Gemini artist. It really doesn't get more, you know, juicy and emotional than it does to be an artist who's also a Gemini. You identify as two of the more chaotic species we have.
Yeah, most definitely. I definitely feel that in my work. Yeah. You know, I've never really thought of it that way, but particularly when it comes to, you know, a role like Moritz, or honestly, the roles that Michael Mayer has gifted me through the years on stage are some of the most, you know, complicated and complex fellas that I've ever been able to take a swing at. And I really feel like those are the Gemini roles. Like, they're complicated and they're kind of hypocrites and they're kind of constantly kind of going back on what they said or what they did. And there's weird kind of lack of continuity sometimes in the decisions that they make. And I think that's why I love playing those roles so much.
Would you say the same applies to your character in Swept Away? Because I know that's your most recent Michael Mayer collaboration.
Yeah, I just finished doing the Swept Away, which you mentioned, with a book by the legendary John Logan and songs by the fantastic band, the Avid Brothers, and featuring Stark Sands, Adrian Ensko, and Wayne Duvall. It's definitely the most prickly, you know, character I've certainly ever played. He's a kind of a con man and an opportunist and kind of classic lost soul. He's the second mate on a whaling ship in the late 1800s, and he's kind of a man who's fallen from grace and is taking odd jobs wherever he can just to kind of keep on the run in his life because he's done a lot of bad things. And it was for as dark as that role was, it was an absolute joy to, you know, be able to sink my teeth into a really heavy character for the first time in quite some time because I haven't been on stage in about 6 years. So wow. It was really a dream, especially with, with all that we've been through and the ups and downs of the theater the last couple of years of opening up and closing and then opening up and closing. And we all got COVID while we were doing the show out in Berkeley. Yeah. And so we shut down for 2 weeks. So I know every time I see a press release about a show shutting down because of COVID cases, my heart breaks because it's a specific kind of falling feeling when that's happening to a company. So anytime I see that happening on Broadway or off Broadway or anywhere right now, I feel for the company.
Wow. I recently heard, and no spoilers, but I heard a brief tease about Swept Away and something twisty about it. And I have to say, Johnny, I was in shock.
Well, yeah.
I'm so curious to see it.
Yeah, I better get to New York.
Oh my gosh. Who can we go petition right now for the transfer? I mean, I'm waiting to hear things, obviously. I know that the smarter people are having conversations behind closed doors about, you know, the future of the show. But you heard it here first, folks. I don't want to be too, I don't want to speak out of school, but I think it's one of the best, and I'm not talking about my work. That's not for me to comment on. That's for, you know, the audience and other people to decide.
Connor and I will.
When you see the show, you can weigh in. But as a piece of work, I think it's one of the most spectacular and interesting things I've ever been a part of on stage in my years. So I dream of it coming to New York so that the East Coast audiences can get a shot at seeing it.
Oh my gosh.
I love, how did audiences respond to it out West?
Great. And you know, you have definitely touched on something. I think anybody who reads, you know, the kind of quick synopsis of the show will think, I don't know. Four guys shipwrecked, trapped on a lifeboat for most of a show. Is that going to be interesting? And turning to some dark survival impulses, perhaps by the end of the show and losing their minds a bit doesn't necessarily sound like the hot ticket item of the summer. You know, we were nervous a little bit about, I was thinking the whole time, you know, we were supposed to premiere the show in the summer of 2020 at the Berkeley Rep. And, you know, we got shut down, of course, because one of the last things that I did right before the COVID-19 pandemic, shut everything down around the globe was take some of our first press pictures for Swept Away. We got in a van and we went up to the Mystic Seaport in Mystic, Connecticut, which is one of the oldest whaling ports in the U.S. And they actually have a museum where you can go on one of the old whaling ships. And we took some pictures there. And I remember we were there and I was with Stark and the cast and we were kind of like, do you guys think this virus thing? Like, I'm hearing like the word pandemic getting mentioned a lot in the newspapers. And do you think we're going to be okay this summer? And of course, a few weeks later, the writing was on the wall. So we had to wait, you know, a year and change to mount the show. And given that the show is intense and the second half of the show, I will say, gets very harrowing and very dramatic and very intense and at times outright disturbing, while never really losing the kind of, you know, through thread of hope and redemption, which really is at the heart of the show. But I was scared because I thought, gosh, is anyone going to be ready to be challenged right now? Like, I feel like maybe people might just want a nice song and dance review or something that's a little simpler, something that they can, you know, check out to and not have to think about their own, you know, survival and our own, you know, humanity and mortality. And lo and behold, the audiences were so game. I mean, they came into it just completely ready to throw down. And, you know, it's a 95 minute piece. It's straight through, no intermission. Cool. So you really are. It's definitely like a run and gun type of experience. And, you know, we had a couple, there's a few moments in the show where I, you know, and I'm on stage the whole time. I'm on stage for 2 hours with no break in this show.
Wow. So,
and we were in a thrust stage. So you're right up in front of the audience. And yeah, I saw some people walking out every night. I mean, maybe they had dinner reservations or maybe they were maybe a little too challenged by the show. But, you know, I know that this isn't saying anything that unique this day and age, because we all know that the standing ovation is just kind of almost everything gets the standing ovation now. It's kind of become the norm. If you're at a show where it doesn't happen, something must have really gone wrong. But I will say that I don't know in my, you know, 16, 17, actually, no, it's actually, oh my God, no, I'm dating myself here. 20 odd years of doing theater. I don't know that I've ever seen an audience jump to their feet as quickly as they did at the curtain call for Swept Away. And I think it just speaks to the emotionality of the show. It's an intense ride. And I think by the end of it, people were just ready to exhale and, you know, stand up with us and give us a nice round. So that was, you know, joyous and so cathartic, especially after, you know, not being able to take to the stage for some time.
That gives me chills. I really, really hope we can see it. That's incredible. And
I'm hoping that by talking it up, you know, someone's going to listen to this podcast mm-hmm. and say, you know what? I wasn't going to let Swept Away open at my theater, but now I've changed my mind based on John's description.
I know, I'm trying to think what theater would be good for it then, if it was a thrust situation.
Yeah. I wonder. I think we all fantasize about, like, you know, Circle in the Square, because they have such a great, you know, you can make that space kind of anything. Mm-hmm. You know, they've done so much. They've transformed it so beautifully. But I'd also, you know, be open to, you know, I've seen some amazing things at St. Anne's or BAM, yeah. You know, something slightly more off the Broadway beaten path. You know, I would be happy finding a home there too. I mean, basically I'll do it on a street corner if they ask me to. At this point, it's just the greatest role I think I've ever been handed. So,
wow.
Oh my God.
And that's really saying something too, because you have played so many incredible characters over the years.
I've been so lucky. Yeah. So lucky, especially with Michael, you know, Michael Mayer. I mean, I refer to it a little bit as the, when we were out in Berkeley and we were working on Swept Away, I told him, I was like, you know, I kind of refer to the three shows we've done together as the trilogy of torture. not because you're torturing me per se, but, you know, he's just, you know, handed me the reins on three of the most tortured men, mm-hmm. you know, that I think I've ever played or seen on stage, between Moritz and Johnny, Moritz in Spring Awakening, Johnny and, you know, in American Idiot, and now the mate in Swept Away. They're just such dicey, intense roles, and they really go, you know, through hell from start to finish of the show, which is, you know, it has its challenges, but it's also such a gift, because, you know, I think as actors, we all want to stretch out. And, you know, when I first read Swept Away, I thought, I can't do this.
Wow.
I just thought they got the wrong guy. You know, they got the wrong guy for the gig if they think that I'm going to be capable of doing this every night. And lo and behold, I connected to the material once we started rehearsing it. And there was just nothing to do but throw myself into it, you know, head over heels.
That's so interesting to hear.
Just impressive that you've got such a great head of hair still after all these years of playing these. I feel like playing these harrowing characters would drive crazy.
Well, especially with the hairspray that I had to apply in Spring Awakening every night to get it to stand on end. It's a wonder that I didn't lose all of it, because it was so mangled and knotted and, you know, full of Aquanet by the end of the run that it's amazing that I have any left.
Well, I've got to say, the cast of Spring Awakening looks better than ever. Everyone looks absolutely incredible in those pictures that I've seen. We've yet to see the documentary, but
I can't believe you weren't invited. That's an outrage to me. There were plenty of
empty seats at that theater. Someone's getting fired. Anyways, that's okay. It's all good.
I'm gonna cause a storm.
No, oh my gosh. It's all good. This is the best thing that could have happened, is us just chatting with you.
Well,
anyways,
it's interesting for me to hear you say, you know, you were presented with this role of the mate in Swept Away. And I'm thinking about, you know, how old were you when you won the Tony for Spring Awakening?
I was just about a week shy of turning 23. Wow. It was right before my 23rd birthday, so I was 22 at the time.
Oh, yes, because you're a Gemini, so June of 2007. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh.
June 17th, yeah, it was right before. And wow. The Tonys were June 10th, so it was right before.
Well, I guess my thought goes into a bigger question, which, of course, will open up a larger conversation about Spring Awakening and your career. But I'm thinking about, you know, at 22, almost 23, winning a Tony Award for this critically lauded and now, you know, iconic piece of theater that has lived on and continues to live on. And I mean, here we are today talking about it with this new documentary. But when you won the Tony, I know we're jumping very far ahead in the Spring Awakening story, but did you think to yourself, this is amazing. I'm amazing. Things are going to be great for me. I have a career. This is going to really help my career. Or what was going through your head?
You know, it's funny because Spring Awakening had such humble beginnings. You know, when I was 20 years old, we did a concert, just a one night only kind of concert version. And that was when I got cast as Moritz. And then, you know, much to my surprise and lucky for me, I was asked to join the company again when we went to the Atlantic in 2006 and opened off Broadway. So I'd been playing the role for quite some time by the time we made it to Broadway. And I was aware that it was a big deal. I was aware that the show was, you know, touching people and that, you know, the audiences were getting bigger each night. And, you know, people started reaching out to me being like, hey, can you get me tickets? And that's always a sign that, you know, your show is going well when people are asking me, you know, for assistance. But I didn't want to get ahead of myself, of course. And, you know, when you're doing a show, it really is one night at a time, one show at a time. But, you know, people kept coming up to me being like, oh man, you know, you're a shoo-in. I mean, this role is built for awards. It's so dynamic and it's kind of a scene stealer supporting role, you know? And I just kind of was like, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. That's none of my business. Like, yes, that'll all be good if and when we get there. But you know, it's January. June is a long way away. I just want to do the show and feel good about my work. And then I think it was like right before the awards, you know, and it was one of those things where I didn't win any of the previous, you know, yeah, awards. So that kind of started messing with my head a little bit where I was like, wait a minute. Okay. Don't people that win usually win something first, you know?
Who was winning them that season? Because that was a big season.
They did a strange thing for the drama desks. They didn't put me in featured for some reason. Oh. I remember that Jonathan Groff and I were both up for lead actors.
Okay.
And I want to say, I could be completely wrong about this, but I want to say maybe Raul Esparza won for that company revival.
Yeah.
Won the drama desk.
Okay.
And so I was in the wrong category because I think Moritz is entirely a supporting role because he's gone by, you know, halfway through Act 2. Mm-hmm. Yes, spoiler alert.
Right.
He goes away.
So that's a good way to put it.
Well, I think maybe I have a chance, but I don't know. This is my first time. This is my first rodeo here with all these awards. So I don't know how things go. And I didn't have a publicist or anything. I was very much kind of winging it. But I remember right before the Tonys, I was in Kimberly Grigsby's dressing room, our music director and band leader in Spring Awakening. And I think Steven Spinella, who played all the adult male roles in the original cast and played my character's teacher and my character's dad, you know, he kind of came in and he was like, hey, you know, the New York Times critics poll did their whole thing. And you're like, the odds, you know, if you're a gambling man, like people should put their money on you because everyone has you, you know, as the winner. So I went into it like very much aware that it could go my way. But like, I'm so superstitious that I didn't want to think about it and I didn't want to jinx it. And it really wasn't until they called my name that it kind of sunk in and hit me that it was like, oh, wow, I can't believe that I started playing this role almost 3 years ago. And now here I am on stage at, you know, Radio City collecting my award. It, you know, it's funny. I've had a lot of time to think about the Tony Award and what it meant to me. And the funny thing is, and I say this now, I mean, there were a few years where I think if you'd caught me on a bad day, I would have been angry about this, but like, it didn't do much for me instantly other than the incredible honor of knowing that, you know, regardless of what happens in the rest of my life, I can call myself the Tony Award winner, which is huge and massive, you know.
What about a salary increase?
You know, there was a bump. There was a bump. I take it back. There was an increase.
But
at the time, you know, and this is, it's funny how much the entertainment industry has changed in the last 15 years because there was no streaming. You know, it was still basically like you had your basic cable TV shows and your network shows. And it wasn't like, oh, John, the TV people are here for you now that you've won a Tony. They want to set you up with your pilot. Like, you know, that certainly wasn't happening. It wasn't like the offers came pouring in. In fact, you know, I left Spring Awakening with no work lined up and had no idea what I was going to do. And then I got asked to audition for a play at the Atlantic and I ended up going back to the Atlantic back. So I went backwards in a way. I didn't see it that way at the time. I just thought, oh, I got to do this really amazing Connor McPherson play, which was totally, I wanted something scary. Like I had played Moritz for 3 years and you know, I didn't want something easy. I wanted something scary and weird and challenging. And I stumbled into this really intense play that's all monologues, this really great Connor McPherson play called Port Authority. Oh. Mm. And so, you know, I think some folks were like, oh, Johnny like went, yeah, he didn't really get like the big kind of gilded ring coming out of Spring Awakening. But, you know, at the time, I wasn't viewing it that way. And then the funny thing is that the whole entire reason that I ended up doing American Idiot was because of Spring Awakening, was because I hit it off with Michael Mayer, and Billy Joe Armstrong, the lead singer of Green Day, came to see Spring Awakening, and he was really touched by it and thought it was really cool. And then Michael pitched him the idea of doing American Idiot as a Broadway musical. And then they asked me to star in it. And, you know, it was almost like, wow, you know, Spring Awakening was one, you know, 3-year audition for American Idiot.
You became offer only after your
show. Yeah, right. I wish I could say that, but just for that show.
That's honestly really humbling to hear though, as well, that it's not like, you know, you reach that pinnacle moment and then it's just shooting for the stars. Like, you have to continue to work and audition, and
you have to work. Yeah, it's life-changing, and yet it's not.
Sure.
You know, that's kind of the way I've always talked about it, is that it there is a before and after. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's a legendary, you know, prestige gift to be given that kind of recognition. So I don't, you know, by any means take it lightly. But then, you know, when the kind of, you know, joyous haze had settled afterwards, it was like, wow, shoot, what am I going to do next?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm going to have to go back into some rooms and audition and, you know, get work again and see where that takes me.
And you were one of the first cast members to depart the show, right? I think Johnny B. Wright might have left. And then
I was, yeah. Yeah, I think Johnny left. And I remember our very first cast member to leave, okay, was Gideon, because it was so, Gideon Glick left in August of 2007. And it was, I just remember we were sobbing. Like, that was when it really hit us that this thing, like, we were going to have to cycle through all these goodbyes, you know, that this incredibly overwhelming life altering experience was going to have to come to an end, as all things do. But yeah, I was the first of the leads, you know. Jonathan and Leah, they stayed on for another like 4 or 5 months, mm-hmm, I think, after I left, but I was one of the first to go.
Yeah. Now, when you look back on those years, you know, y'all were the toast of the town. Everybody was in love with you. I mean, the lines out the theater and everything. What do you remember most? I mean, I remember Connor and I were obsessed with this backstage video of, I think it was Jonathan hosted it, of for Broadway World or Broadway.com, like showing everyone all the dressing rooms and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And I just remember thinking of it as this, like, this moment in time of just like, you all were like this bunch of kids basically having this crazy moment.
In the Gap. Remember the Gap campaign?
Oh my God, the Gap ad. Yes. The Gap ad was traumatic to shoot because I got stranded. I remember I got stranded in one of the dressing rooms. They took the sweaters away from us. You know, we were wearing these like these plush kind of it was a winter campaign. So we were in these bright kind of colored sweatshirts, and they came and took them away from us at the end of the shoot. We weren't allowed to keep them. And so the Gap people had to come in and collect them. And I was in this dressing room down the hallway, and they took the shirt away. But then I remembered that my own shirt was down a long hallway in a different dressing room. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have to walk down the hallway of this building with no shirt. And I'm, you know, it's not like it's a fun thing to look at. This so scrawny, pale, pasty 22-year-old me. But I was like, well, I've got to go get my shirt. And I walked down the hall, and I walked into the other dressing room, and Amy Adams was standing there because she was about to do one of her own shoots. And so she just sees this, like, you know, pale, pasty, scrawny kid with no shirt on walk into the dressing room. And I was humiliated, and I grabbed my shirt and ran for the hills. But I digress. That's just a little tea for you there. I've got, oh, there's countless. There's more where that came from. But no, it was insane, you know. And I think because we had such humble beginnings, like I said, you know, we took it in stride. You know, I think with the exception of, like, I mean, Leah Michelle had been playing that role for like 6 years in workshops. She'd started playing Vendela when she was like 14, and I think she was 18 or 19 by the time we got to Broadway. And so, you know, she was like so pro, and we all looked to her like, oh man, she is a total, like, totally belongs on Broadway, like, totally knows what she's doing. But we were all kind of finding our footing, and it was my second Broadway show. I had done Rabbit Hole right before that. In fact, I did my last show of Rabbit Hole in April of 2006. And the very next day was my first rehearsal for the off-Broadway run of Spring Awakening. But I think because, and this is a testament to Michael Mayer and to Tom Hulse, our producer, and to Jim Carnahan, our casting director, that, you know, they really went out of their way to find kids that, you know, weren't jaded, hadn't spent too much time on stage. We weren't like show kids. There was something real about what we were bringing to the table. And there was something real to the way that we were trying to take it all in stride and not let it go to our heads that we were, you know, the hot thing that year. You know, I mean, we certainly enjoyed it, but it something about how overwhelming all of the attention was, I think it made us get really close. Because we had to cling to each other because no one else understood, you know, how strange it was to suddenly be thrust from a 200 seat theater where, you know, nobody was waiting for you at the stage door to suddenly find yourself up on 49th Street coming out of the Eugene O'Neill with, you know, 100, 200 some kids lined up around the block to talk to you. You know, it was.
Yeah. And a lot of them were like repeat offenders. They would come back and over again, they'd sit on stage and all of that. We didn't get to see it until after Kyle Riabko, Alex Sosha, and Blake Bashoff were in the leads. It was like a month after Leah and Jonathan left. But even still then, it was crazy. It was absolute insanity. I'm curious to know how much the cast, how you all felt, because this was sort of one of those first shows where social media was really becoming popular. Like, forums aside, like Twitter, I think, came out around the same time. And how much was the cast, you know, hearing or seeing things like on online about them and the way that the fans were reacting?
Well, it's so funny, is I feel like our run of the show, like the run that I was in, I feel like we missed a lot of that. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember specifically, like, when I think of, like, I had a flip phone the whole time I was in Spring Awakening, you know, and so I wasn't scrolling, you know, backstage or anything. I remember at the time, the big thing, and I know it still is a big thing now. I'm not trying to say that it has lost any of its potency, but, like, you know, all that chat and the message boards, like, that was the big thing back then. That was kind of like where people went. And then, you know, I think MySpace was the only thing that we all were using MySpace. But I think Facebook at the time was still regulated to colleges. So none of us were on it until a couple years later when they opened it up to a much more mainstream thing.
Yes. I remember actually discovering the show on MySpace.
Really?
That's how I found
it. That's so funny.
Yeah.
I remember the first iPhone I ever saw, I want to say, I think they both got them around the same time. I think it was Matt Doyle. Like, I remember Matt Doyle being backstage and being like, whoa, can I look at your phone? And I was like, this thing is so cool. I guess I'm going to have to get one. And I think Gideon got one.
I think he's still obsessed with, like, the Apple releases.
Oh, really? Too, I mean, he had his finger on the pulse. He was the first one I ever saw.
These aren't the stories people are going to hear in the doc. They're not going to hear about, phone on.
I want something special for your listeners here.
Well, on the topic of the documentary, what has it been like to reunite with everyone? What is it, like 15 years later?
15 years later, yeah. I was November 15th. Our first preview, I believe, was on the 15th in 2006, right before we opened on Broadway. And so, I mean, it kind of was a pipe dream. I remember about a year ago, I was in North Carolina shooting a film and, you know, I got a text from, there's a Spring Awakening text chain that we're all on.
And yes, I have heard about this. Yeah. This is quite legendary.
In fact, it's going off right now. I can see some people, because everyone's excited about this.
Who is the most active?
Who is the most active? You know, I feel like it might be Lauren. Like, Lauren Pritchard's really active on it. Brian Charles Johnson's really active on it because he's hilarious. I mean, he's arguably the comedian of the company. Like, he's so quick-witted and so funny. He's always, like, you know, he's always there with some joke that we all wish.
Some meme. Is he sending the memes?
There's memes. There's definitely some memeage going around. But I remember the text chain came to life and they were like, hey guys, would everybody want to hop on a Zoom to talk about the potential of maybe a reunion show? And I was like, yeah, sure. And we all got on a Zoom and hadn't seen each other in a really long time. And then there we all were. And I was like, is this going to work? You know, and it was pre-vaccine, you know, the vaccines hadn't been rolled out yet. And so everything was very uncertain. And I just thought, and there was talk about doing it virtually, like maybe we'll just film it. And then as we started discussing it more and more, and it really was Lauren Pritchard and John Groff, they were the people that really spearheaded this and made it happen. It became evident within just a handful of months that we were going to actually be able to do it one night only at the Imperial Theater. And we were going to be able to have an audience, and it was going to be this, you know, fundraiser to benefit the Actors Fund. And it came together so quick, and everybody just jumped on board and said, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a real gift to get to come back into, you know, what was wildly informative and massive, this huge moment in our lives 15 years ago, and revisit it, not just the material, which has been, you know, amazing to get a chance to sink our teeth into again, but just our connections and our personal, you know, journeys, and being able to come back together as adults, mm-hmm. you know, and hang out with each other again. It was really amazing. And also, you know, just while we're on the subject, I remember, like, one thing that I'll always credit it with is that when I got cast in Swept Away, as I said, I was thinking, I don't know if I can do this. I might have to turn it down. The material's really heavy. And to be honest with you, I started getting, like, late in life stage fright. I never had stage fright when I was younger. When I was doing Spring Awakening, the best part of my day was 8 o'clock, you know, when the lights went down and we walked out on stage. I mean, I woke up looking forward to it. And as I've gotten older and, you know, life has changed, there are days where I wake up in a cold sweat, you know, thinking, oh my God, I have to go do Long Day's Journey into Night Tonight. And it's 4 hours, and I'm going to have a panic attack in my dressing room and barely make it out on stage. And I was in the thick of that in the last couple of years, in the throes of it, to the point where I was going to quit theater. I just thought, oh, man, you know, I'm going to tell my agents, I just can't do theater anymore. It's too hard. It takes too much of a toll. I don't have the confidence that I had as a young man, and I'm going to have to hang it up. And I felt pretty darn sure of that. And then, especially with musicals, because I hadn't done one in a decade since American Idiot, and they just are more work. They just are. It's much more work than a straight play, because, you know, the things that you can get away with in a play, you can't always get away with in a musical, because you really have to protect your voice. You have to protect the instrument. You have to get enough rest. You can't spread yourself too thin, or you just won't make it through the 8 shows. And I learned that the hard way in both Spring Awakening and American Idiot. So, I promise this is going somewhere.
No,
but what happened was, you know, walking out on stage again and getting to play, you know, what is, like you said in your beautiful introduction, like, you know, the role that I think I'm the most known for, and the one that I think matters the most to so many theater goers, was Moritz. And it was so encouraging to get to walk out on stage and get a nice round of applause, and then, you know, go for it and play that role and sing those songs, and to make it through the show and be like, oh, right, I forgot. I do really like doing this. You know, I do like going out there and doing this. And I feel like it totally helped me get over a little bit of that stage fright. And it really, because a couple of weeks later, I started rehearsals for Swept Away. And I felt like without that night at the Imperial, this is making it a little bit more about me than Spring Awakening, but without that night with my cast again, going out there with that amazing audience, knowing we were doing something good for the Actors Fund, knowing we were revisiting this material, it was massive. It helped me so much get psyched about going out on stage again. And I don't know that I would have been so game and ready for Swept Away had I not had that amazing gift of being able to do Spring Awakening again.
Wow. It, you know, what you're saying, it sounds like you had a late in life Ring of Keys moment, what we call on the podcast, you know, borrowing from Fun Home, that, you know, that moment of revitalization at this point, but maybe realizing, like you said, I do love this. I love doing this.
Yeah.
I guess on that topic, do you feel like you had one of those moments earlier on in your life or career where you were like, oh my gosh, I love the arts, or I love singing, I need this in my life. You feel it?
I do. I think, you know, I really think it was the very first time that I ever performed on stage. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, in a small suburb, in a small state. In fact, the second smallest state in the union, second only to Rhode Island, who beat us a little bit in the smallness. But there was a theater called the Wilmington Drama League. It's still there. I still try to go and hang out with the people that are doing work there whenever I'm home. And I was 12 years old, and both of my siblings and my mother had done a few shows there. And I would see them and think, God, that looks like fun, you know, getting up on stage. And I was like a weird, this must be the Gemini thing too. I was like an introverted ham. Like I loved kind of attention, but then I also wouldn't want any of it for a while. And so, and I'm still that way, but I tried out for a production. They were doing a production there of Frankenstein, of Mary Shelley's, you know, Frankenstein, yes, being an adaptation that was really loyal to the book. And I got cast as the young, I think it's the nephew or the son of Victor Frankenstein, who in the original novel meets a very gruesome demise at the hands of, you know, Dr. Frankenstein's creation. And so I have this death scene on stage when I was 12 years old, and this guy Raymond Harrington played the creature, and he was amazing. And I thought he was so cool, and he was this big guy, and we choreographed this death scene where he strangled me to death and kind of broke my neck, and he was able to kind of pick me up by my jacket, but it really looked like he was strangling me, and it was visceral and intense. And talk about walkouts. I remember somebody walked out because we were this little community theater. And suddenly it was like, they're killing a kid on stage. And I remember somebody running up the aisle one night. But I remember after the death scene, you know, when you're doing something that, and you can feel that it worked, when you're like, oh my gosh, the desired effect was completely achieved. Like, we terrified people. We got them to believe in that moment that this, you know, preteen child was massacred on stage. I remember walking off into the wings after the first show, and it's a little bit like when you're a kid and you go to a carnival or an amusement park or something, and maybe you go on some awesome slide or some ride and it ends, and then you realize, oh my God, I can just get back in line and do it again. Like, I remember thinking, wow, I get to do that again tomorrow night. And that realization, and it's one of the things that I still love about theater, for all of the wear and tear of doing a long run, like the chance to keep refining and trying things, and the chance to have the desired effect get achieved every night for an audience is something that still thrills me. And I had it in Swept Away every night as we got to the end of the show, and there's some intense plot twists and big reveals on stage. It's, you feel a bit like a magician, you know, like you wield the power of storytelling, and it's a total drug, you know, it's an absolute high. And I remember feeling that I think they probably call it the bug, you know, the acting bug, or whatever, yes, you want to call it. But I felt the bite, you know. I remember thinking, oh my gosh, this is awesome. I want to chase this feeling.
That's awesome. You know, it's funny. You're talking about being in Frankenstein and Spring Awakening, Swept Away, American Idiot. You, every project you're in seems to have such darkness in it, even like Hush and
oh yeah.
But you know what I loved that was a nice surprise to see you in was your episode of Modern Love.
Oh, thanks.
Which was, yeah, so sweet. And
it was sweet.
Oh, I loved it. You were great.
Thank you. Thanks. That was really fun to film because it almost felt a little bit like theater. You know, it was just me and Sophia Boutella, you know, and these long scenes. And it was based on, I mean, what's amazing about that show to me too is that, you know, they're based on these columns, these guest columns from the New York Times, but they're all true stories. Mm-hmm. So that really befell some young man, was on his like second date with the girl of his dreams, and he, you know, fell off the couch and cut his arm open on a martini glass, and she had to take him to the ER, and they had this kind of really quick, you know, they had to get really intimate with each other really, really quick and really fast. And so that was really fun to shoot because we had these long scenes together, and it almost felt like we were doing a two-hander play or something.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, and then I feel like I have to ask you about Short Term 12, which was like such a surprise piece for everyone, you know, like no one really knew what it was going in. And then what a gag.
Yeah. I mean, it's launched. Well, it's not like it launched. Like these people were obviously already working, but you know, when you look at like Brie Larson and Keith Stanfield and Rami Malek and Stephanie Beatriz, like, you know, Caitlin Dever, there were these young performers in that show. I mean, there's two Oscar winners now between Rami and Brie, and Keith's been nominated, and it was Keith Stanfield's first thing, you know, I mean, he was 20 years old and it was his first role. when we did that film together. So it was one of those moments in time, I feel like, a little bit like Spring Awakening, where this young cast came together. And I've often also thought it would make a great musical. Like it, you could do it like a Spring Awakening type of musical if you had these kids, you know, that were able to, because it takes place in this foster care facility and it's about the kind of hidden wishes of these wounded youth, you know. But it's one of the best times I've ever had making a movie was making that one, because it was just a real labor of love and we shot it really fast. I think we shot it in like 21, 22 days. And for a modest budget, we all just kind of threw ourselves into it and it was a joy. I'm very proud of that one.
What was the experience like doing Westworld?
It was a trip because I was coming into it in its third season. So they had been doing it for a while and it was a very well-oiled machine. And it's also very secretive. They're very secretive. Oh, yeah. It's a little bit like the Marvel movies over there. Like, you know, I remember they were like, hey, Jonathan, my agents were like, Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, I want to talk to you about doing like a couple episodes of this new season of Westworld. And I was like, okay, great. Well, can they send me the script or the thing? And they were like, they're not going to be able to, like, they don't allow it. Like no one can read them. They're just going to Zoom with you and they're going to kind of pitch you the role. And so they did, they kind of explained the whole role and the character arc and everything. And I ended up saying yes, because I just thought, man, there's so many people on this show that I admire, you know, Anthony Hopkins and Ed Harris. I mean, some of my acting heroes. And
yeah,
and the scope of it is so exciting. What they pull off for an episodic series is so cinematic, and you know, you feel like you're watching a short movie every night.
Oh, 100%. The quality of the cinematography, the effects, everything.
Yeah, it's top notch. And so, you know, I thought, well, that might be cool to be on a set like that for a little while. And and it was, and you know, I got to work with Evan Rachel Wood and Aaron Paul and you know, Tommy Flanagan, some really fantastic actors. It was that was a cool couple months. It was like I got to dip in and out too, because I was, you know, I live in New York and they shoot it in LA. So I would fly out for like 3-4 weeks of filming. Then I'd come home. And then a couple months later, the phone would ring and they'd be like, hey, they're ready for you again. And I'd get back on the plane and go back out and film some more. And then I'd come home. And so it was fun.
Oh, I love it. You've done so many things. I feel like I've heard you talk about The Newsroom and Jerusalem and Long Day's Journey into Night before and other projects. And I feel like I wish we had so much more time with you. But before we say goodbye, we do like to end with a dose of drama, something to leave our listeners with. It could be, you know, something you want to recommend, rant about, rave about, just share with everyone. And Dylan, do you want to kick it off today with a little dose of drama?
I do. My dose of drama, of course, has to do with you, Johnny. It's it's this incredible album that you released a couple of years ago that I think that it is just such a vibe. And there's a little something for everybody on there. But it's one of the songs in particular, Sarasota Someone, that I am obsessed with.
Wow.
I think that everyone needs to go stream this. You are such a great songwriter, Johnny.
Thank you so much. That honestly means the world to me. That really does. My songwriting is something it's actually, I would say, probably more personal than the work that I do as an actor, because it comes completely from me. No filter, no editor, no revisionist other than me. And so my heart is in all of my songs. And so when it means something to someone, it means the world to me. So I really appreciate that.
It's weird the way that it is a very specific song. I mean, I think it is, but it made me feel like home for me. Like I was like, oh, like I feel like I'm driving around my hometown, or like, you know, with the windows down and it's nighttime. I don't know. It's really interesting.
That's really great. That's the goal. You know, I think that's what I, you know, I want. The whole reason that I write music or get on stage is to, you know, is for to feel less alone myself, and then maybe by virtue of creating, help someone else feel less alone. You know, that's really the nuts and bolts of it for me.
Mission accomplished.
Thanks.
Love it.
Connor, would you have a dose of drama for us?
I do. I wish I would have started, because it has nothing to do with like complimenting Johnny, but I would, you know,
we've done a lot of that.
I mean, he's amazing, but I want to complain for a second. I'm feeling dramatic because New York can be so, you know, it's such an expensive city. Everyone knows it's, you know, it costs you $100 to, you know, buy a bottle of water at the theater. It's really crazy. But I'm feeling dramatic about when you go to look up a restaurant and you find it and you're like, oh, the prices look great. Like all these pizzas, it's like pretty well priced. But then you get there and you realize it costs like $8 to $10 to add any kind of like pepperoni or any kind of protein to these pizzas or to a salad. It really, you are taking out like a small business loan to dine out in this city at any time and just to add a little bit extra to your meal. And it's drama. I've had enough.
And it adds up. And when you're looking at the statements at the end of the month, you're like, what? How did I spend that much on that?
It's
crazy.
You know, that's definitely one of those, man, in terms of the prices you pay for living in this city. I mean, that's a massive one.
It's wild. Do you live here?
I do. Yeah, I've been in New York. I moved to New York in 2002. So I've been here for 20 years.
Okay. Oh my God. Yeah. The 20 year anniversary.
Not a bad distance if you ever want to go home to Delaware.
Yeah, no, I exactly. It's, you know, I'm going to go home for the Mother's Day weekend to see my folks, which I'm looking forward to. But yeah, I've been here for a while. You know, I might have to move. You know, that's kind of my drama right now.
Yeah, what's your drama?
My lease is up at my place, and I've been here for about 6 years, and I can't help but, you know, be feeling lately that it might be time to branch out and go elsewhere. I don't know where or when, but I suddenly looked at the calendar the other day and was like, oh my God, my lease is up in July. What am I going to do?
Oh.
So that's kind of weighing on me because, and as any New Yorker will tell you, moving in New York is a unique kind of hell.
absolutely.
Moving anywhere is stressful, but particularly in New York City, it's unique.
You strike me as a Brooklyn kind of guy.
I am in Brooklyn. I live in Fort Greene, and I've been here for 6 years. And then there was a period where I lived in kind of Cobble Hill, Borham Hill area for a few years. Never done the Williamsburg thing. I've never made it that over there. Never made it that far.
Okay. You give a Williamsburg vibe.
I guess so, right? Yeah, I guess between the, you know, doing indie films and theater and, you know, playing rock music, it definitely, you know, you'd think Williamsburg is the place to be for me. But I love to visit. I love going over there, but I've never lived there. But yeah, I guess that's the, I've lived, you know, I lived in the East Village, the West Village. I lived in Cobble Hill. I lived in, you know, Fort Greene. I lived uptown. I lived downtown. I lived in Queens. I lived in two parts of Astoria. I've lived all over the city. So the question I'm suddenly kind of asking myself is, well, where to next? I don't know. I guess only time will tell.
Wow. That is drama. Yeah. I have to say, everyone in New York is always talking about like if their rent's going up or looking at apartments or finding roommates or living alone or.
Oh, and it always is. Uh-huh. Yeah. The rent is always going up, you know, every year for me.
Well, I'm glad you're staying in New York because there's definitely things on the horizon for you. And we will be keenly tuned in to whatever it is. Johnny, this has been such a treat for us. If you can't tell,
we are
true guilty ones. And you have been such a key part of our, a ring of keys moment for us, you know, back in our days. So thank you for your time today. Everyone should, of course, follow you to keep up with, you know, the music, the work, the apartment search. You're at John Gallagher Jr. on Twitter and on Instagram. You're at John Gallagher Jr., but Jr. is spelled out.
Yes, J-U-N-I-O-R, because somebody had already put my name up there with the J-R. So.
Of course.
They beat me to it. You know, I was snoozing and I lost.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Like Dylan said, this has been a pleasure.
You're so welcome. Likewise. It's really been great talking to you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. And everyone should tune in to Spring Awakening, Those You've Known, which is now available. And of course, follow me at Dylan McDowell, Connor at Connor McDowell, the podcast at The Drama Podcast. Give us a 5-star rating. And Connor, I will see you next time.
Drama.